Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Leviathan by Catherine Levesque. Narrated by Paul Woodson. The History of the Black Church Guild. St. Giles de Bottreaux was a knight who had been disgraced for using unconventional tactics. Having served the Duke of Normandy, he was present at the Battle of Hastings. Unfortunately, he caught wind of a Norman lord who was about to betray the Duke, and he tortured the lord to gain valuable information about the Saxon resistance. He was vilified for it. St. Giles was released from the Duke's service because the rebel Norman was both a rich man and a distant cousin of the Duke's. With no means of income, St. Giles and his brother, St. Lion, wandered England, unable to find a suitable position. In desperation, they were forced to become part of a Saxon pirate group out of Watermouth, Devon. Realizing that piracy was lucrative and putting their knightly skills to good use, the brothers quickly rose in the ranks and ended up commanding their own ships. St. Giles eventually formed his own pirate crew with the help of his brother, men known as Triton's Hellions. Their ships were the Argos, the Mount Pelion, the Pagasa, and the Athena. St. Giles's specialty was in recruiting disgraced knights and giving them a new and rich career. Those knights began training other knights for a life of piracy at an abandoned church on the shores of Lake Cocytus in the Exmoor Forest. The place was called Black Church because it was a black, burned-out shell of a former sanctuary. But such a place, hidden from the world, was a perfect staging ground for a warrior's guild. More trained men meant more ships and more wealth. The pirate ships sailed the known world, bringing back men as well as treasure. As the years passed, those same ships brought diverse warriors from all over the world to the shores of Devon. While St. Giles settled in to manage their growing empire in the Exmoor Forest, St. Lion assumed the pirate enterprise. All of the trained warriors he brought to Black Church combined with other elite trainers to create the most complex and comprehensive battle training system in the world. England, who had always dismissed Black Church as a pirate training ground, gradually became aware of the quality of those who had completed the course. They were the best educated warriors in the world. The Earl of Wessex was the first to come to St. Giles and ask him for some of the fine men he'd trained. Soon, fully trained knights with good reputations began asking for admission to the training grounds to learn the Black Church way of life and warfare. It became lucrative and prestigious. St. Giles's grandson, St. Andrew de Bottreaux, was granted the title Earl of Exmoor by Henry I because St. Andrew gifted the king with an elite group of specialized knights who saved the king on more than one occasion. Soon the crown got behind this extraordinary training ground. Black Church's reputation was cemented. These days, Black Church is far less about piracy and far more about training the most coveted and skilled warriors the world has ever seen. Men and women are accepted as long as they are qualified and can pass the entrance test. Every trainer has a specialty. New classes of recruits are formed monthly from qualified applicants from all over the world, and each group of recruits spends at least 6 months with every trainer. To pay for their training, they either pay the fee once they pass the entrance test, or they pledge a portion of their salary once they graduate and find a position. Training is harsh and intense. It is expected that even out of the vetted recruits, most will fail. Those few who succeed will become forever known as Shadow Knights, a coveted title denoting their superior status. As graduates say, you don't simply survive Black Church, you become Black Church. England's most elite training school, knights of the highest order. Numquam dedite, never surrender. The family tree of de Bottreaux and the trainers of Black Church. De Bottreaux tree, lords of Exmoor who run Black Church. St. Giles, born 1040, was part of the conquest of 1066, died 1100. Brother, St. Lion, served with him as a pirate, and it is St. Lion's descendants who continue to run the pirate conglomerate known as Triton's Hellions, now run by St. Abelard de Bottreau. St. Simon, born 1070, deceased 1135. St. Andrew, born 1094, deceased 1160. St. Paul, born 1119, deceased 1195. St. Denis, born 1147. St. Denis has two sons, St. Gerard and St. Sebastian, a.k.a. Sebo, born 1171 and 1173, respectively. Both trained at Kenilworth and Warwick Castle, veterans of the Third Crusade. Current list of trainers. Moniker is listed after ancestry. Tay Monroe, Scottish, Greek, the Leviathan, teaches endurance, physical fitness, structure and discipline. He's the boot camp, the gateway to the rest of the training. Sinclair, Sin, Durain, Norman, the swordsman, sword training, warfare, military history, how to command an army, etc. Fox de Merest, Norman, Saxon, the protector, teaches men how to defend and kill using daggers and other weapons. He's the MacGyver of Black Church. His class is about defense and thinking outside of the box. Payne Matheson, Scottish, the Tempest, teaches offense, instructs men on how to size up enemies and figure out their weaknesses, how to fight battles from the ground up. Christian Heldane, Dane, the Viking. He is seabound. Everything he does is on water, fighting on water, instruction on boats, etc. Creston de Royans, Norman, the Avenger. Interrogation, treatment of the enemy, anything underhanded. How to handle torture and difficult conditions. Sometimes works in tandem with the Conquistador. Amir ibn Rashid, Egyptian, the North Star. Military history, global, and tactics from other armies. Understanding different cultures and how that dictates their fighting techniques. Cruz Mediana de Aragon, Spanish. The Conquistador. Conquest and diplomacy, politics and art of negotiation. Bribes, coercion and leverage. Sometimes works in tandem with the Avenger. Ming Tang, Chinese, former Shaolin monk. Name means bright water, the dragon, fighting kung fu using hands and feet only. Fighting with the mind and not a weapon. Meditation for a warrior to calm the mind and the spirit. Author's note. Wow, a new series. My last new series was in 2019 with the Executioner Knights, so I am super excited to roll out this brand new, action-packed and diverse group full of swoon-worthy knights and the badass ladies who tame them. You are going to love, love this new series. There is a lot of information rolling out for you because this is a full-blown new world. Don't let it intimidate you, because once you start reading this novel, you won't be able to stop, I hope. One of the things that is different about this new series is the diversity. The 13th century was when men started really exploring the world. Especially with the advent of the Third Crusade, travel was more normal than ever. The Silk Road from China, which had started as trade routes back in the 5th century, was introduced to the Europeans around this time. Men and material came along that route, so piracy at that point in time was becoming more lucrative. People from China, India, Afghanistan, and many other regions and countries were now coming to Europe. Immigration was happening. It's very exciting to have some of those worldly travelers show up at the Black Church Guild. In some of the notes prior to the start of the story, I've outlined the basis of the Black Church Guild and given you a scorecard of sorts so you know who the players are. You'll meet them, of course, but sometimes it's good to have some reference material when a lot of people are being introduced. Mentions have been made about the Black Church Guild in the Executioner Knights series, because a couple of their own have trained there. So it's time to clarify why even the Executioner Knights have a healthy respect for the Black Church Guild. Once you graduate from their training course, you're known as a Shadow Knight. That's like being called a general or doctor or lawyer. It's a title earned, and it means something. Now, back in 2019, I wrote a series for a publisher that revolved around a training ground for medieval gladiators, basically. If you haven't read this series, it's called Scots and Swords. It revolves around a gladiator school run by a guy who models it after the ancient gladiator schools of Rome, and was set in the 15th century. I really loved that series, and love the idea of training grounds for the best of the best, but the mention of the Black Church Guild actually predates that series. I just happened to flesh out the medieval gladiators first. Black Church is a training ground for warriors. But that's where the similarities end to the gladiator school. You'll see that it's completely different. While that series focused on the trainees who go through the program, this series focuses on the guys doing the training. It's a great world, and they're very protective of it. And each other. Additionally, another similarity to that series is that in the third book, there was a minor character named Tay. It's a common enough Scots name because there's a well-known loch named Loch Tay, so any similarities between that minor character and the hero of this tale are unintentional. I just happened to like the name and the character's background, so I brought a version of it to this series. Black Church is intended to be one of the worldliest places in England at this time in history, meaning it's very diverse when it comes to its trainers. Lord Exmoor spared no expense in gathering the greatest military teachers he could find, including a former Shaolin monk. Shaolin Kung Fu and Chan Buddhism began about 100 years after the fall of the Roman Empire, well in advance of the High Middle Ages, when this book is set. Therefore, we have a Shaolin monk whose religion, at that point, had been around for about 700 years. Was it possible that such a man would make it all the way to England? Of course. The Silk Road, the legendary trading route, had been in existence for hundreds of years before the year in which this story is set. It is more than feasible that men from the far east of England would make their way along that road, travelling west until they couldn't travel any further. This is also just after the Third Crusade, in which hundreds of men from countries in the Levant, and points even further east and south, made their way into Europe. This was a time of migration, and of cultures learning of other cultures, so our former Shaolin monk isn't only possible, it's probable. Now mentioned in this story is a duchy called Toxandria. It was a real place, a region in the 4th century that encompassed both parts of Belgium and parts of the Netherlands. In this story, it's a duchy, a dukedom, that is much sought after and rich. Our heroine is from this region. Our hero is Scots and Greek, as his mother was born in Athens. Talk about an international flavour. But one thing to keep in mind about the Black Church Knights. They make the Executioner Knights look like high schoolers. These guys are nastier, meaner, more brutal, and there may be a scene or two in this book that is not for the faint of heart. When dealing with Black Church, no rules apply. And with that, I sincerely hope you enjoy the kickoff to a brand new series that I'm absolutely thrilled to write. Hold on and enjoy the ride. Happy reading. Catherine. Prologue. Duchy of Toxandria, near Ghent, Breder Castle, year of our Lord 1209. They were coming. She'd known all along. The glow of a distant fire lit up the horizon as the northern edge of her village began to burn. She could smell the smoke and see the ash in the air as it blew upon the gentle sea breeze. She knew the army was methodically destroying the cottages and liveries as they made their way toward the castle. a massive monument to men and conquest that her family had lived in for generations. The tall grey walls of hand-hewn granite had protected the House of De Ghent for all that time. But in this case, she knew they would not be enough to keep the last remnants of her family safe. A storm was approaching. Athdara De Ghent was the last line of defence between her family's survival and the very man who wanted to see them all wiped out. As the daughter of the ruling duke, she was now faced with defending her father's legacy against a man they had all once loved and cherished. A man they had trusted their entire lives, someone who had hugged them and been kind to them. Now that same man, her father's brother, was coming to kill them all. Athdara couldn't let that happen. Her little brother Nikolai was the object of her uncle's rage. Her father and older brother were already dead. She tried desperately not to think about it. She only wanted to think about the situation at hand, because it was up to her to ensure Nikolai's survival. Her parents, loving and kind people, had two children at first, a boy and a girl, and then another little boy well after. Athdara's elder brother Milo had been the heir to her father's dukedom. Milo would have made a perfect duke, so his death was more than tragic. It was an absolute injustice against the people in her father's dukedom, as well as her close-knit family. She would miss Milo's impish smile, his taunting ways, and his dedication to Doxandria. He'd had such goals and dreams. But it was fitting that her father and Milo had perished together, defending the town they both loved, because she knew her father could not live without his eldest son. Moreover, she doubted her father would have been able to live with the idea that his own brother was intent on destroying him. Death, in this case, was probably a blessing. But it was the end of all things, Athdara knew. Armageddon had arrived, and she was hardly prepared. With her father and brother killed in the initial assault, she was now in command. Their village was a walled stronghold, so the breach in the perimeter wall had taken time. It had given Athdara and the small army her father had left back at the castle time to reinforce the castle walls and the access points. Her father's duchy had always been a peaceful realm, so the attack on the village had overwhelmed them quickly. Her father never had carried a large army, but her uncle had spent the past 2 years recruiting mercenaries and other misfits into an army twice the size of the one her father had. Athdara suspected that Breda Castle would not hold out for long against the larger army determined to overrun them.
"My lady,"
an older knight named Alan was at her side,
"we cannot reinforce the postern gate in time."
Athdara, clutching young Nikolai against her, looked at him in horror.
"God," she breathed. "I'd completely forgotten about that gate. The hinges rusted and Milo never...
"Repaired them correctly," Alan finished grimly. "We told him time and time again that it was a weak access point, but he laughed and told us not to be troubled. We chained the gate to keep it secure, but your uncle's army... the chains will not hold."
Athdara looked down at Nikolai. He had only seen 6 years. He was just a baby born to reinforce the dynasty when Athdara's mother had shown concern for the continuity, if something should happen to Milo. That concern had cost the woman her life when she died in childbirth. Now that small child stood between the Duchy of Toxandria and the greed of Attila De Ghent. Athdara was sick with the realization.
"Then if it will not hold, we cannot remain here," she said, her voice trembling. "Even now my uncle is on his way to Breda, and once he arrives he will seize the castle and all within it."
Alan nodded sadly.
"It would be foolish to remain," he said, his gaze moving to the little boy with the big blue eyes. "You would never see Nico again."
Nico, the nickname of her baby brother. A sweet child that Athdara loved dearly. She had raised him since birth, a surrogate mother to replace the one he'd lost. So in a sense he really was her child. And she would do anything to protect him.
"Then we must leave," she said decisively. "Help us, Alan. Secure the boats that will take us from the river to the sea. That is our only hope."
Alan nodded swiftly. "I was hoping you would say that," he said, reaching down to pick up the boy. "It has already been done. Hurry, my lady, there is no time to waste."
Athdara ran after him, her long legs keeping up with Alan and his men as they raced through the familiar corridors of Breda, past chambers where there used to be love and laughter, past halls that had belonged to her father. Chambers and halls she would never see again. There would be time to grieve later, but now she had to flee. She had to save Nikolai. There were shadows in Breda this evening. Everything was dim because they did not want to light up the interior of the castle to give Attila any advantage. Light could illuminate people and soldiers, giving him more of an advantage than he already had. So the corridors and stairs were dark, but for one of Alan's men with a torch. Down, down they went, to the maze of servants' chambers near the great hall, and then finally out into the kitchen yard beyond. The moon was silvery on this night. The smell of hay and animals assaulted Athdara's nostrils as she ran toward the gate, with Alan still holding Nikolai. There were several men with them now, heavily armed, prepared to defend what was left of Duke Alexei's family. Alexei had been a good man, and had earned great respect from his people. Perhaps that was what Attila envied the most, a duke people had loved. The postern gate in question was being opened as they approached, men opening the big rusted lock and removing the chains. There was a hint of desperation in the air as they tugged at the old iron, freeing the gate and throwing it wide. The River Mark ran adjacent to Breda Castle and down the slope, peppered with thorny vines and foliage, and boats awaited. Clutching Alan's tunic, Athdara followed the man as he charged through the opening, heading for the boats below. But that was the same time that the sentries on the wall started shouting. Men were approaching. Athdara had never seen so many weapons, or heard so much shouting. Suddenly there were men everywhere. Fighting ensued. She heard Nikolai screaming, and Alan's firm, steady tone. But those were her last coherent memories, as Attila's army descended. After that, death and chaos reigned.
Chapter 1. Year of Our Lord, 1212. Black Church Training Grounds, Exmoor Forest, Devon. He never knew what hit him. One moment, a stout recruit from Sudbury was standing there, and in the next, he was on his back, staring up at the blue sky. The blow he'd just taken literally knocked the wind out of him. He couldn't speak. Not even to groan. He simply lay there and choked until a massive shadow stood over him and thumped him in the chest.
"Breathe, Edgeworth," came a voice that sounded like Lucifer himself. "Do not hold your breath. Breathe."
He thumped him in the chest again, and the man on the ground drew in a long, ragged breath, gasping for air. Until that point, those around him seemed to be holding their breath as well, wanting to see how the man was going to react to such a blow. It could have gone either way. He could have succumbed to it and they would have carried him off the field, or he would climb to his feet and continue the exercise. Recruits at Black Church, once carried off the field, did not return. That was the rule. It was a bright day on the fields of Devon, a bright day in the midst of several weeks of bright days, which was unusual for what was usually termed a stormy coast. The north coast of Devon, facing the Bristol Channel, could be turbulent when the seasons warranted it. Those dark seas, with waters the colour of sapphire, could churn up the silt and turn shades of green and brown. They were active waters, full of pirates or merchants, or both. They were seas as dark as the Exmoor Forest itself. Much like Cornwall, Devon could be a mysterious land. It was far from London, far from most of the hustle and bustle of England as a whole,
and it tended to have its own legends and ambiguities. There were beasts that roamed the moors, and wood sprites waiting to trap unsuspecting men. Fae lingered in the vales, and serpents swam in the lakes. Devon wasn't heavily travelled when it came to the Exmoor Forest, an area that sane men would stay away from, and that made it a perfect place for the most elite training ground in England. There were great castles, like Kenilworth and Berkeley and Warwick, who trained powerful knights that went on to serve great lords and kings. Those were the reputable castles with the reputable training programs, and nearly every nobleman's son in England aspired to train at one of those great training grounds. And then there was Blackchurch. It was in a league of its own. As the man who spoke like Lucifer moved to the edge of the combat field to select another club, because the one he'd used on Edgeworth had cracked down the middle, he could see a couple of men lingering on the edge of the field. Casually he tossed the fractured club aside, and went to weigh a couple of other wooden weapons that were propped up in an iron stand. Out of the corner of his eye, he could see the men approaching him.
"I'm surprised he can rise after a blow like that, Tay," an enormous man with black hair said. "That was a brutal strike."
Taman Rowe glanced at the man, a comrade and a friend, whom he'd known for years.
"He deserved it." "Why?"
Tay found his club, feeling the weight in the palm of his trencher-sized hand.
"Because he has been faltering as of late," he said, glancing at the group of trainees as someone peered at the blood trickling from Edgeworth's scalp. "He seems to have lost his motivation. I was trying to help him find it again."
"He is on his feet. That's something."
Tay looked at the man.
"You've done the same thing, Fox," he said. "I've seen you punish a trainee or two with that superior skill you've acquired. There is no one finer with a blade than you, and you make sure they know it."
Fox de Merist, a powerful knight with both Saxon and Norman blood flowing through his veins, fought off a grin.
"That is my job,"
he said, casually scratching at his neck.
"I teach them skills they'll not get at Kenilworth. Only the strong survive. If men wish to be a shadow knight, then they must earn the title. 'Tis the way of things."
"Brawn is not always the way of things."
Tay and Fox turned to the third man who stood with them. He was shorter than they were by far, but that smaller stature did not mean smaller strength. In fact, his body was solid muscle. Sinewy and powerful, the man who went by the name Ming Tang was not only an anomaly in England, but he was an anomaly anywhere in the Western world. There were few like him, this man who had made his way from the Far East by way of land and sea, finding his way to Blackchurch, where he taught those there skills that put them head and shoulders above any warrior on any field of battle. Mysterious arts where a man used his hands and feet to fight, using technique over sheer strength to subdue a man. Ming Tang was a legend. But he was also a friend to Tay and Fox, and he was unafraid to make his opinions known. Something else he'd brought with him from the Far East was wisdom that exceeded anything the Western world was capable of, because those in Ming Tang's land thought differently. They viewed life differently. It was that difference that made him so incredibly valuable and unlike anyone England had to offer.
"Brawn may not always be the way of things, but it has served me well and these men must learn it," Tay said. "But those without the brawn will have to make allowances. Sometimes strength is not all about a man's muscles."
Ming Tang's lips twitched with a smile.
"I wonder who told you that?"
"A man who looked like you."
Ming Tang's smile broke through as he looked at Tay.
"Then the trainer becomes the trainee once again," he said. "I have faith that my teachings have not gone to waste with you."
"I told you I wasn't stupid. Dense, mayhap, but not stupid."
That brought a chuckle from Ming Tang.
"You are nothing of the sort," he said. "You are the Leviathan, bringing chaos and damage wherever you go.
I should not like to be on your bad side, my friend.
Tay flashed straight white teeth.
Then stop trying to teach me your mystical philosophies, or that very well may happen, he said. I am a simple man. You must treat me simply.
With that, he lifted his new club.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?